Do a reading, 2-minute meditation, prayer.
This one's called Commitments. Maiden plucks folk tune on steel strings. Crickets chant like monks. I've walked into autumnal contentment, yet a young boy seeks guidance. One may be quite far along on the path, but if one meets a beginner who sincerely seeks guidance, then one should help without reservation. If such a beginner were to come to you, what would you say? This is what I said to someone today. The time of beginning is one of the most precious times of all. It can be very exciting and full of wonderful growth. The first thing to do is to make up your mind that you're going to go the distance. When I first began, I made a lifelong commitment. I determined that I would learn from my teacher or sponsor for at least 7 years. Now it has been much longer than that, but the essential element is still the same, commitment. But commitment needs something else in order to be perpetuated. It needs discipline. This is the perseverance to keep on when things are tough. Adversity is life's way of testing and perfecting a person. Without that, we would never develop character. Rice suffers when it is milled. Jade must suffer when it is polished. But what emerges is something special. If you want to be special too, then you have to be able to stick to things even when they are difficult. Commitment and discipline. These are two of the most precious words for those who seek spiritual growth. 2-minute meditation. The way of life described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is not for the faint of heart. This path, for me, is about the refinement of my character. I don't do the workout of the Big Book to stay clean and sober. I'm long past that point. I do the work out of the Big Book because I am clean and sober. It makes sense. I don't know if I made a commitment prior to even being incarnated into this body. I'm a guy that thinks and believes that I did. This agreement was made for this lifetime. I don't know what your agreement is. Maybe we can make an agreement now. You have to answer the question. Am I willing to commit to this way of life? And am I willing to be disciplined as I commit to this way of life? Because character refinement, I mean, I always picture a piece of ornate wood that you sand, and you sand out all the imperfection, you get it nice and smooth, and you spray, you put a stain on it, and you spray a coat of lacquer on it. And it's protected for many years. On this path, there is no stain and there is no lacquer. We are sanded all the time by God. And sometimes we think all the imperfections have been sanded out, but they're not. And if anyone's taken some sandpaper to some wood and you start sanding, or use the sander, it gets really hot. There's a burn, and there's a friction. And for me, that's what this path has become about. Constantly burning, the burn stops. There's an escalation in my spiritual growth, and then a burn begins again. And something else about me changes. Some other chunk is ripped out of me that's not really even me to begin with. And it's like God is a sculptor, and he's just chipping away. The problem I have is he starts chipping away, and I'm like, don't chip over there. I want you to chip over here. Right? That's what we do, right? That's what this path is about. If you commit to this path, the 12 steps, and your discipline around the practices that the big book shares with us, you will be able to weather the storm that's coming. Because I promise you, there's a storm coming. There's many of them coming. But if there's no commitment and no discipline, you're not going to stay. It's only commitment and discipline that will allow the roots, your roots, spiritual roots, to grow deep into the ground so you can weather the storm. So, question to contemplate. Am I willing to commit to this disciplined way of life?
So, who in here, I bet you raised your hands before, who in here has been through a program like this before and then relapsed? All right, so that's more hands than there were the other night, so that means we got a little more engagement. Okay, so new guy, real quick, what happened when you left here?
All the way up until the relapse.
Just the last little bit. What was that? You came across something? You what? Okay, and then what happened? Okay, did you choose to do that? Okay. James, what happened last time you relapsed?
Last time I relapsed? I mean, people, places, and things. If you go by the same people you ordinary, you know what I'm saying, deal with, instead of trying to make new friends or around people that's trying to do better for themselves, it ain't gonna work.
Okay, and then
it's just gonna be a matter of time.
And then you made a choice to pick up.
Eventually, you gonna get high.
Okay,
straight up, ain't no getting around or nothing. You gonna get high.
Who else chose to get high or drunk when they relapsed? Okay. Okay, good. Good. Go ahead, Tarek.
If you fit the description of the alcoholic and addict in the big book and you believe you made it.
Real quick, does anybody know what the first step says? Powerless over alcohol, cocaine. Right. Okay. Powerless, right? You guys got it. All right. Now go back.
If you fit the description of the alcoholic and the addict in the big book and you believe you chose to relapse, you have completely misunderstood the first step. Pages 23 to 43 are the least understood pages in our big book. If you've been stripped of power, how the hell can you have a choice? You can't be powerless and have a choice. So let's talk about that. It's really easy for alcoholic and addicts to see that once I start, I don't have a choice. All bets are off. I lose control. I get that. Is that, am I cool in saying that in this room? You guys see that?
Once you start, you can't stop.
Once you start, you can't stop. You guys see that really easy, right? Easily.
Until you run into something or somebody, police, consequence, wall, something.
Typically, we are stopped. We don't do the stopping. And the grace of God would qualify as something stopping us. But when I sit down and sponsor people, I've had guys I sponsor come back from relapse on many occasions over these 10 years, and they tell me I chose to relapse. And I tell them exactly what I just told you. I'm sorry, you misunderstood everything I tried to teach you in the first step. Maybe you weren't present to our conversations. I don't know. But here's how it breaks down on page 24, this idea of choice. It says, the fact is that most addicts and alcoholics, not all of them, most, for reasons yet obscure that we don't understand, we've lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, these are the three most important words in the paragraph, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink or drug. So check this out. Would you guys agree that the word choice implies options? Correct? And when you have options in front of you, you evaluate your options when you're making a choice. Is that correct?
Yes.
And then you do one of two things. And let's say you're looking at option A, B, and C. You examine option A, and you either accept it or deny it, reject it, correct? Mm-hmm. Option B, accept, deny, or reject. Deny and reject, same thing. Deny leads into the word denial. I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but the word denial is used one time in the first 164 pages. It's in Bill's story, and he's talking about the conversation with his father denying certain things about God. The authors of the big book, I think, were purposeful in leaving the word denial out. They use words like delusion, illusion, obsession, and then they use a phrase called, or a phrase that says you can't tell the difference between what's true and false. That's not the same thing as denial. Our family members, like my parents and my close friends and my brother, they were in denial around my addiction. They saw the elephant in the room and they rejected it. My son can't be a drug addict. He made straight A's in school. Right? Me, on the other hand, I don't even know the elephant's in the room. There's a difference. And so what does this look like?
Your family tells you, you have a problem. No, I don't. You have a problem. You just parked your car in the living room. No problem.
And growing up in this Western culture, it's very hard for us to wrap our minds around this idea that from a state of consciousness called sobriety or being clean, I don't have a choice. So I'm going to be very descriptive. So I had this job. I worked in an office. And I'd be clean for a couple of days. I'd be sitting in the office. And all day long, I'm getting this idea to go downtown and buy crack. Okay? And the idea comes and I fight it off. I go through this thing that we call making a choice, which I call an intellectual sorting out process, right? Examine options, accept or reject. All day, I can't spend the paycheck. I got to pay these bills. I've got to get Sherry something for our anniversary. I've got to be at mom's for dinner tonight. All these reasons come, right? I'm rejecting. I'm denying the thought to smoke crack cocaine. I go through the intellectual sorting out process. My willpower is accessible in those moments, so I think. And then my day ends at the office. I'm walking to the parking garage. I get in my car. I drive out to the main road. Now I either go home if I drive straight, or I get on the interstate and I drive to downtown Atlanta. I pull up to that light, and the intellectual sorting out process that I have engaged in all day is suspended. I beeline it downtown. In that moment, at that certain time, I was unable to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering or humiliation of a week, or in that case, it was a few days ago. I couldn't bring into my consciousness the need to be at home so I don't spend the week's paycheck, or to pay back somebody I owed some money to, or do this or do that. At certain times, my intellectual sorting out process, which this world calls making a choice, is suspended. I'm without choice. How the hell do you protect yourself from that?
And what we want to do is we want to look at the two or three, or maybe more, probably not, times where we were able to make a choice. I went to the bar with some people after work. I had two drinks and I left. I want to remember that one time that I was capable, and I want to completely forget about the 25 others where I go and have two, supposed to be home at 7 because we have dinner guests coming over. And after 42 phone calls to me, I show up at the house around 9:30. Everybody's left. Oh yeah, I was supposed to cook. Oops. That was not a choice that I made. Well, that was talking about the little bit of the physical, but understand that it's those times where I thought that I could choose to leave or choose to not go at all that made me believe that I had some power in the situation.
Page 24. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer or one hit off a stem do not crowd into the mind to deter me. If these thoughts occur, they're hazy and readily supplanted by the old threadbare idea that this time I will handle myself like other people. It won't happen this time. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
If you guys ever put your hand on a hot stove, what happens? It's like, wow, it's hot. You're like, whoa, right? Now, in that moment, do you sit there and go, you put your hand on the stove and you go, wow, that really feels hot. I feel like I should move my hand, but wait, is it really hot? Let me see. I guess, yeah, I'm smelling burning flesh. Maybe I should move my hand now. Okay, I'll move my hand. Okay? That is a thought process. But what happens? You touch it, you're like, ah! Right? So if we feel that kind of pain from what we do when we're using or drinking, one would assume we get the same reaction, right? Is that your experience?
If you're in fit spiritual condition, though, you will recoil like a hot flame. It does happen like that. But,
so we try to do some fun stuff at our house, and anybody ever seen the show Chopped on Food Network where these people cook? Well, we did a Chopped Junior with our kids, and we gave them certain ingredients, and they had to come up with stuff. They actually produced some pretty good stuff. But my son made this like Dijon sherry vinaigrette dressing that was freaking awesome, right? And so I used it as a marinade on a steak, and it was also awesome. But there was a little bit of the marinade left in a little bowl one night, and I took it and before I dumped it out, I just wanted to taste it, and I guess like the sherry had just floated to the top, and it got on my tongue, and I'm sitting there in the kitchen, and I'm going like just having these like horrific noises coming out of me. And my wife's over on the couch, and she's looking at me, and she's like, are you okay? Like, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm like trying to wipe my tongue off. And then I realize, holy crap, I actually used to intentionally put this stuff into my body, and the reaction I was having this time was as if it was a hot stove. I mean, it was like so disgusting in my mouth that I wanted that removed from me. Okay? That that's a fit spiritual condition reaction to alcohol versus me going, wait, there's alcohol in here. It's pretty good. I'm going to try a little more. So for me, it was a very physically, like, strong example of this is what happens to me today. I don't fire off into the phenomenon of craving right away because I'm in fit spiritual condition.
This is the most difficult part of the first step for most individuals to really see, is that they don't have a choice before they ever put it in their body. And the reason is because that intellectual sorting out process that I described is suspended. And you don't know what the certain time looks like. I don't know what the certain time looks like. So that's why I have to do what I have to do on a daily basis to stay in conscious contact, to stay in fit spiritual condition, so I'm always in a position to recoil as if from a hot flame. That's how this process works. But when I saw this, I will never forget sitting at this guy Dante's big book study at his house, in his game room, reading this paragraph, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I don't know what that certain times looks like when my willpower is going to be suspended. And I can't bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memories. I can't play the tape through because the next paragraph says we get to a place where we can't think at all. This is called the strange mental blank spot. So the only way I have found to protect myself from that is by cultivating a personal relationship with a power greater than myself that I choose to call God that I do not understand. That's it. But as long as I think I have a choice, it's not like I work the steps and now I have a choice. Those people trip me out. I always ask, you know, when people say, but what kind of God would give you a choice over something that can kill you? Why wouldn't he just remove it altogether? So this morning when I woke up, I brought four shirts with me, right? I had those to choose from. When my alarm went off, I said, okay, do I want to sit in meditation first and then hop in the shower? Or maybe I'm going to hop in the shower, then I'll meditate. Or maybe I'll just take a shower, I'll read a little bit, and then I'll sit still once I get over to the bridges. The fourth option was like, let me go find out where the crack spot is here. It's been removed. It's never on my table for an option because I'm in fit spiritual condition. So I don't choose to stay clean and sober. I just am as a result of doing this work. If you're going to carry that into this work, you're going to have a very arduous and miserable recovery because you're constantly doing things to keep yourself sober. I do things to stay connected to God. It's been a very long time, very, very long time since I've even had the thought of I got to do these things to stay clean and sober.
Who in here knows what the relapse is going to look like? I mean, not after it happens. We all know what it's going to look like after it happens. Just complete train wreck. But like, what are the exact set of circumstances that will come into your life that will make you relapse? Does anybody know that?
Peers.
What's that?
Peers.
That's the only thing ever. Okay, so we don't know what the exact set of circumstances are going to be that is going to make us relapse, right? Well, because I don't know that, how do I defend against that? If I know that the enemy's coming from that side, I can defend that side. If I know that the enemy may come from that side or that side, I can defend those sides. If I have no idea up, down, around where the enemy's coming from, how do I defend that?
Stay spiritually
fit. I have to stay spiritually fit. And that's the only choice that I have here. Is to be spiritually fit or not. And this, guys, this shows up. I'll tell another story. This showed up for me. I was about 3 years, no, 2 years sober. Perfect day. Nothing wrong in my life. I'm at my parents. I'm hanging out. I'm the grill master, so the grill's a little bit lower. They live on a lake. Everybody's up in the house having a good old time. They're all hammered. What do you do at the lake? You get hammered, right? Unless you don't participate in that anymore, which I don't. So I'm usually the only one that's sober enough to cook because I haven't had anything. So I'm down here. I'm grilling. End of the perfect day. Spent the whole day on the lake. The lights coming up off the lake. Good, nice crisp fall breeze maybe blowing through. It's wonderful. And the thought comes into my mind. You know, a beer would be nice right now. A beer would be nice right now. I do what I usually do when that thought comes. I chuckle and I go, you're not capable of having a beer. You're going to have a case. So that was an intellectual sorting out process, right? Thought stays. You know, I could walk right down the patio, go into the rec room, go into the beer fridge. It's literally a beer fridge. That's all that's in there. And grab one of those. Everybody else is upstairs. They will never know. Okay. It's kind of getting a little bit real. Maybe I should call somebody. Thought stays. Thought stays. Thought stays. Well, that was Saturday. It's Monday. I'm talking to a sponsee of mine, explaining to him what had happened. And he said, so what happened? So what do you mean? He goes, well, you didn't drink, so what happened? I don't know. He's like, well, you didn't go get a beer, right? I'm like, no. And he said, so what happened? Why did you not drink? Did you call somebody? No? And he's asking me these questions, and I'm completely baffled in this moment because I have no idea what happened. I didn't call anybody. I didn't make a choice. I don't know if a boat came roaring through the cove. I don't know if the grill flared up. I don't know if somebody came down. I have no idea what happened. But here's what I know. I didn't drink. Something came between me and the thought that I was having that I need to have a drink. Something. You call it whatever you want. I'll call it God. God separated, removed that thought from me. Brandon did not choose to not drink that day. However, Brandon did not drink that day. When you're spiritually fit, things like that will happen. How many other times in my life has that happened? I have no idea. You know why? Because I didn't talk about it with anybody. The thought of the drink has been removed. It does not exist for me. Doesn't mean one doesn't cross through. They cross through. But that's about it. I don't make a choice. That choice has been removed from me.
So if you're in this step, the first step, and you're looking for ways to see if you're mentally powerless and you've been stripped of the power of choice, that's one way to do it. See, look into your experience and see how with no premeditation, you've just completely gone. Other times your willpower has been suspended after a period of fighting it off, so the choice is unavailable. Then there are the days when you woke up and you maybe had to be at the probation officer, you had to go pick up your kids, you had to do this, you had to do that. You chose not to get high or drink when you first started your day, and a few hours later, you're drinking or getting high. And then there's, of course, the ones where we hear a lot is the firm resolution. How many times did we quit forever? Those are all different ways to find your mental powerlessness. But when you start to really see that you have no idea at certain times which direction the enemy is coming from, you will do whatever you have to because you can't protect yourself from that. There's got to be something that steps in like Brandon is describing. So, you know, just trying to avoid people, places, and things, that's not going to work. You know, it's just not. It's conscious contact, being in fit spiritual condition. You're always available for the whatever this power is to protect you like that.
And it can't just be defense from my peers or those people, places, and things. Because, guys, my family, they enjoy drinking. And they're good at it. They've reached professional status.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a choice. If it's truly a choice of the people that I'm around, I can choose to not participate with my family ever again. Because when we get together, that's all that happens. There might be some Christmas going on or some Thanksgiving going on, but it's really about drinking. Okay? So I can either choose to participate in that their life or not. But I'm spiritually fit. I'm pouring them drinks. I used to be a bartender. I'll pour them drinks now. Neutral. Doesn't affect me. Now, don't twist this around to say that Brandon and Tarek said that I can go hang out with all my old buddies. That's not what we're saying. We're saying once you've gone through the steps, you get to a position of neutrality, you can be around these people and be unaffected. Tarek has gone to concerts where people are smoking shit and doing shit right around them. He's still there with them, unaffected.
I got to tell a story. Are you done?
Yeah.
So I was at a panic show. This was New Year's Eve 2013 or 14. I'm with my buddy that's in the program. From time to time. More in the fellowship than the program. And all my friends around us have bags of Molly and cocaine, and they're doing key bumps, and they're smoking, and they're drinking. And one, you know, people are always offering me stuff, and you know, and I just say no, thank you. And they offered us some cocaine, and they turned away, and my boy turned to me, and he's like, "Man, that looks so good." Something along those lines, like, "Don't you wish you could do a little bit?" Or, "Damn, that looks good." And I turned to him and I said, "Man, I'm in fit spiritual condition." I don't know if I phrased it just like this, but I don't see that stuff. It's like invisible to me. The fact that you actually see it the way you're seeing it means you're not in fit spiritual condition. All right? This stuff works like that. It's that powerful. But you got to go through the process. So I cut myself off from everybody for 6 months because I gave those first 6 months in recovery when I got out of jail. That's all I did was this work. And then I dipped back into that environment. And I had a road dog with me. Like I dipped back into this environment solo. That was years later when I would go solo. So we're not giving you any type of green light, but we're giving you an idea of what the potential is and what the possibilities are. So
I want to throw a consideration out that it's going to piss a lot of you off, and I realize that, but it's maybe something to consider. So what I hear a lot of people do is they have a relapse and then they want to claim all of the time that they had before the relapse. Okay? Well, I had 8 years once. I had 6 months once. I had a year once. Okay? Is it possible that you've never truly been clean or sober? Because the obsession was not removed from you. And that by the mere fact that you relapsed, it corrupted every experience that you had prior to that relapse. You have today and the days between now and the day you got clean and sober, and that's it. Everything else that happened prior to that is worthless. You may have gained a bunch of knowledge. You may have gained a bunch of information. Doesn't count for shit.
There's a guy in my program right now who had this amazingly powerful spiritual experience around the third step, and he just thinks it's a sufficient. He's like, "You know, I've been changed." And his sponsor was like, "But you got high again, right?" He's like, "But you don't understand. I had this really powerful experience in the third step, and I know God now." He's like, "But you got high again." You know, he keeps trying to bring in this old experience as if it's sufficient now for his spiritual awakening. And so he's nonchalantly walking through the steps because he's buying his time because he has to complete the program. But it's what goes in line exactly with what Brandon is talking about here.
Tarek and I rework the steps on a regular basis. We got together with another guy 6 months ago or so. And the intention that we set before going through the steps is that we had no idea what we were doing. At nearly 10 years sober, 6 years sober, the other guy had 6 years sober. We went through the steps as if we were newcomers. It's humbling to realize that all of everything that I've done prior to this time is worthless. So consider that unless you are truly in a position of neutrality, you may not even have the time you got right now.
Oh, you.
So, page 25, the middle of that paragraph that starts off with there. Well, we'll just go through it. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process, the program, requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that Tarek and Brandon really seem to be working it. And if you've come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of the life as you have been living it, then when Tarek and Brandon, who seem to have the problem of been solved kind of sounds a little permanent, doesn't it? Not like temporary, not like one day at a time, but solved, right? Problem's fixed. There was nothing left for you to do but pick up what we're offering to you and work with it. We have found that much of heaven had been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. Like I talked about yesterday, you can't know what's on the other side of the mountain until you get to the top of the mountain. Fourth dimension shit? Oh yeah, it's out there. Read some books. Read some books and then go back and read them again and realize that when you read them the first time, you had no idea what the book said. This book still has new stuff in it all the time for me. This is the great fact is this and nothing less. That Tarek and Brandon have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized their whole attitude towards life, toward their fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of Brandon and Tarek's lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. When you get beat into a state of reasonableness by your disease, your drug of no choice, you hear us talk about that. Like, people say, well, my drug of choice is... What was your drug of choice, Tarek? What did you like?
Whatever drugs you had on you.
Okay. See? But Tarek's drug of no choice, the thing that he had no choice, power, or control over, was crack cocaine. So when people in meetings say, my drug of choice was alcohol, I didn't choose alcohol. Alcohol chose me. I'm sure that there were some other things out there that I might have enjoyed, but... So, my drug of no choice dictated to me when, where, and how I was going to do it, and how much. Made me do all those things I didn't want to do.
And that's the key, what he just said. Made me do all the things I promised I'd never do. No substance. No other substance did that to me. I had a loss of control around a lot of substances, but cocaine was the only substance that created pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization in my life.
One of the most horrific things I could imagine me doing was stealing from my 6-year-old son his birthday money so that I could go buy some drinks. Okay? That may not sound bad to you, but that's horrific for me. I stole from my 6-year-old son. That would be a pretty shitty choice to make, wouldn't it? Or was I just satisfying King Alcohol? If you are seriously alcoholic or addict, as Tarek and I are, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. If you are in a position where life was becoming impossible, If you passed into the region where there was no return through human aid, yours or others, you're left with two choices. Go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of your intolerable situation as best you could, or accept spiritual help. Now, I realize that for a lot of people that looks the same. If you're sitting in here and you don't believe in God and you don't want to believe in God and there is no God and whatever Brandon and Derek are talking about God, that they're just whatever, and you cool. Then there's another option for you, not God. Because if you get to a place where you don't care anymore about arguing over whether God exists or not, and you just want to get clean and sober, welcome. If accepting spiritual help looks like death to you, that's another option. Two options. Spiritual help, or go on living the way that you've been living. And if that's working for you, keep doing it. If that way of life still works for you, just keep doing it. We got a napper. All right.
So, we're sort of wrapping up the first half of the first step. We're going to do a little bit more when we get to more about alcoholism, but I think we've beaten it up pretty good. So, something that you guys have to wake up to, at least I woke up to, was this idea that alcohol and drugs did a tremendous amount for me. Otherwise, they would have never done so much to me. So when I first discovered the power of drugs and alcohol, they created a huge change in my psychic, my psyche. Something changed. I discovered a solution. A lot of people thought I discovered maybe a problem, but I'm like, what are you guys talking about? I finally found something that works, and I want to keep doing it. Page 27 describes a spiritual experience. And it talks about Roland Hazard going to see Dr. Young, and he spends a year with him, and he's drunk on the way to Paris on his way home to the States, and he goes back to Switzerland, and he's like, Doc, man, I just spent a year with you here. What the hell's going on? Why can't I stay clean and sober? And he says, you're hopeless. You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic.
I just spent 6 months at the Bridges of Hope. I got blessed out. And now I'm back.
So you go to Pappy, or you go to Bill Brown if you're at Louisville, and you're like, are there exceptions to cases such as mine? And the doc says, yeah, exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, an alcoholic or a drug addict have what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. I can't explain them. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some emotional rearrangements with you, but I'm a human. I can't do that. With many other individuals that are hard drinkers, my methods seem to be successful. But I've never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. See, Dr. Young understood the problem. He understood the solution. But he had no program of action to bring about the psychic change or the spiritual experience. But what's really interesting to me is this description of emotions being displaced and rearranged, and a new set of motives and conceptions beginning to dominate. That's what happened to me when drugs and alcohol began to work in my life. I discovered a power greater than myself. That's some powerful stuff. It began to do for me what I could not do for myself. It provided me with a much needed psychic change. It gave me a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from my insecurity. And I'm telling you, if this is going to be a successful part of your life, you're going to have the same experience again and maybe again and maybe again and maybe again with the 12 steps in a spiritual way of life. And I'm not saying the 12 steps are the only way to have a spiritual experience. That's not what I'm saying. We have not cornered the market on spiritual growth. The 12 steps are an effective approach that has worked with me. And I think very highly of this 12-step process. And I think it works 100% of the time. That line in how it works, it says, rarely have we seen a person thoroughly follow our path. That's what it should say. The book says, rarely do we see a person fails thoroughly follow our path. People rarely follow the damn path in the book. Right? Somebody's sitting in this room right now going, man, fuck these two guys. All I want to do is quit shooting dope. I don't have to do the shit they're talking about.
You may be right. Are you willing to gamble your life on it? Up to you.
I'm telling you, if you fit the description in this book, there is no easier, softer way. You think there is. And these are questions you have to ask yourself. It goes back to the reading at the beginning, commitment and discipline. Whatever you found in drugs and alcohol, you must find it here. You must find it now. So, we're going to take a break. 15 minutes.